if we can have young children and students in elementary and secondary school engage in creative and productive activities, that is, expose them to writing books, to putting on plays, to doing science experiments, to writing biographies, we increase the likelihood that they will develop as creative adults who will also seek this type of work.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Cindy Burnett.
And my name is Dr. Matthew Werwood.
This is the Fueling Creativity Podcast.
On this show, we'll be talking about creativity topics and how they apply to the field of education.
We'll be speaking with scholars, educators, and resident experts about their work, challenges they face, and digging deeper into new and varying perspectives of creativity.
All with the goal to help fuel a more rich and informed discussion that provides teachers and parents with knowledge they can use at home or in the classroom.
So let's begin.
On today's episode, we are joined by Dr. Sally Rees from the University of Connecticut's NEEG School of Education. Dr. Rees is a professor of education psychology and is best known for her work on academically talented students and extending the school-wide enrichment model to better support and identify talents and potentials in students who have not been previously identified as gifted. She was principal investigator for the National Research Center on the Gifted and Talented for 20 years and has authored or co-authored over 250 articles, books, book chapters, and technical reports. Dr. Rees is also the former president of the National Association for Gifted Children and has been honored with the highest award in her field as the Distinguished Scholar of the National Association for Gifted Children. Sally Rees also has a bio just as long for her work in administration at the University of Connecticut, but in the interest of time, I'll stop there. Sally, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show, so welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Matthew and Cindy. It's great to join you. I'm going to enjoy the conversation.
So, Sally, this season we've had a couple of episodes dedicated specifically to gifted and talented students, and I thought it might be helpful to begin our conversation today about why teachers need to be more aware of this field of gifted and talented, and why is there such a focus on creativity with gifted and talented students?
Well, it's a good question. I think, first of all, most teachers that are currently working have not had a lot of background in the pedagogy, the right pedagogy to use. So the pedagogy of teaching these students, what do we do for them? How do we teach them? How do we eliminate content that they already know? How do we provide creative opportunities? And because they haven't learned a lot about how to teach these students, a lot of these young people end up doing work they already know, and they end up languishing in classrooms. So we believe, first of all, that understanding the pedagogy, the various kinds of teaching strategies and learning environments that work for this population is a critically important thing for us to do in professional development. And secondly, the field and knowledge of gifted education, one of the major goals of many gifted education models and programs is the development of students' creativity so that we will have the next generation of inventors, producers, painters, artists, engineers, high creatives that are doing good work in our society. So this type of education benefits the entire globe.
So when we talk about creativity and gifted, why is it that we can get buy-in around creativity in gifted students, but not in just your standard educational curriculum?
That's an excellent question. And, you know, something that I've been pondering more and more recently. I think because of the focus on scores, and I think also many lay individuals, many parents, many administrators believe that our students are having fun and being creative, they're not learning something. Well, I flash back to one of my very first years of teaching, and I was an English teacher, a ninth grade English teacher, and my students were doing Shakespeare, and I had them turn certain parts of Midsummer Night's Dream into content that was more contemporary and more comical. And my principal walked by and students were doing a play, standing up, having fun, you know, learning Midsummer Night's Dream. And my principal called me in later on in the day and said, if they're laughing, they're not having fun. So I think creative teaching methods are generally not necessarily those that a lot of parents and some educators believe will have the outcome that we want, which is too often in our country, higher scores and better grades, as opposed to more creative and productive work.
I'm trying to translate that now into the gifted. So if we look at gifted, we can bring creativity in because we know they're, are you saying that because they're going to have high scores because they're gifted and talented?
Well, certainly that's one reason. I mean, there's a rationale for saying these kids already are up there. They're already scoring. So can we do something different? But keep in mind, there are many different gifted education programs too. Some that have a goal of advanced content, and there's nothing wrong with advanced content. So, you know, there's advanced placement courses really value advanced content to prepare students for college. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Our belief, my belief in the gifted education program that I've developed with my partner, Joe Renzulli, called the school-wide enrichment model, is that the goal of gifted programs should be creative productivity in children. And so, in a nutshell, if we can have young children and students in elementary and secondary school engage in creative and productive activities, that is, expose them to writing books, to putting on plays, to doing science experiments, to writing biographies, we increase the likelihood that they will develop as creative adults who will also seek this type of work. I think that's what we understand from our four decades of work in the school-wide enrichment model, and that is that when you look back at the creative, productive work of people in their 20s and their 30s, even in their late teens, much of it goes back to school experiences that enable them to understand and experience the joys of creative work. And when you've experienced that as a child, there's more of a chance that you want to replicate that as an adult. So we're interested in engaging students in creative, productive activities, projects, research studies, again, developing their interests so that we can hopefully point them in a direction for their future creative productivity. Increasing the reservoir, as I said, of artists and dancers and engineers and historians and psychologists. The area doesn't matter. It's the need for creative productivity within that area that is so important to us. And we think it's so important to gifted education and the education of students with talents. And in the model that Joe and I have developed, we extend this pedagogy to all students. So here's another really important thing. You often don't know which students have the potential to be highly creative if you don't give them creative opportunities in classrooms. So we can't just say it's the top 5% or the top 10%, because sitting down there in the 15th or 20th percentile of achievement could be your most potentially highly creative students. So we want to give some opportunities for creativity and creative productivity to all students. And we do that in the school-wide enrichment model by offering an opportunity called enrichment clusters to all kids. So all students have some opportunities, as well as opportunities for what we call type 1 and type 2 enrichment. Exposure to new ideas, topics, opportunities for invention convention, opportunities for creative and critical thinking activities, you know, et cetera.
And I have a follow-up for some of the teachers out there that hear creative production and they're thinking about making films or writing books. I mean, you emphasize that there's lots of different ways that we can engage in creative production. But I just want to kind of follow up on some of the things that you alluded to when we're talking about interests and exposure. It's also not just about the actions associated with creating and making something, but it's within that experience, allowing the students to connect with their passions, engaging in projects that they truly value. So if I'm a teacher and I'm, let's just say I'm a teacher, a technology teacher, and I'm having my students create a film project, how might I help them engage in those types of passions that might fuel them and motivate them after graduation?
No, first the issue is finding out if there's a current interest. And so younger students have many, many interests. When you look at the interests of, you know, kindergartners, right, really all, right up to fourth or fifth grade, you see so many, you know, dinosaurs and castles. You know, they like knights. They're interested in plants. They're interested in bugs. They're interested in pop-up books. And then when you get to about fifth or sixth grade, you see a decrease in those interests. And what ends up happening is there's been less and less time devoted to those interests in school. So first and foremost, you want to find out if interests already exist. And we have developed something called the Interestalyzer. So there's hundreds of versions of it on the internet. This is an instrument that Joe developed, and you ask kids questions, you know, if you could go into a new city, where would you go first? And then you give them choices of content areas like an art museum versus, you know, a feat of engineering or architecture or history, et cetera. But essentially trying to find out if interests do exist. And then if they don't at that point, trying to create interests by providing opportunities for enrichment. So, you know, most kids still have interests. Giving choice, open-ended choice assignments. So if I'm a technology teacher, the example that you use, and I'm going to have my students do a film, ask them what they'd like to do a film about. If they're going to do, if they're going to create a small website, what do they want to create a website about? What are they interested in that day? And understanding too, it's the capacity to have and develop an interest that's so critical, because interests in children generally change over time. I mean, some kids. And I have a grant right now with the federal government, and we're studying students who are both academically talented and also have autism. Some of the students, and we're looking at transition to college. How can we make these students be more successful at college? Some of these young people that we studied that have been very successful were passionate about one thing from the time they were children: meteorology, 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 meteorology. And guess what? They're in Ivy League schools studying meteorology. So that interest, but that's not the majority. The majority had interests in one area, and then they had an interest in another area. Sometimes this is a result of a special teacher or a class or a lecture. So it's the capacity to have an interest and then knowing what to do with that interest that makes a difference, because, you know, students on their own don't have the tools and don't have the sophistication to be able to pursue an interest. And so what we're looking for is giving them the steps they need to have to actually pursue that, to carry out something, and to create, you know, even a small service, a small product to begin with that can then turn into something bigger as they get older, more sophisticated, and have more tools at their own disposal.
I got one more follow-up. I'm sorry. So this is a personal follow-up as a parent. I have sometimes wondered if me having too many interests has potentially left me too confused, overwhelmed, and pursuing too many different paths. And I feel I'm too far now to address that problem. But I'm looking at my 10-year-old, and you ran through that list of interests. He's had that list. He's had that list for a while, and the list continues to expand. And I don't know what to do with it, because I can't accommodate every one of these interests. And I have started to worry, how is he going to navigate which interest is right for him? So I just had that question. I was just wondering if you had a response to that problem.
That's a very good question. And I will tell you that there's something that we call in our field called multipotentiality. So, you know, one thing is saying it's great to have interests, but do your interests and your talents in that area match? So, you know, I might be interested in being an opera singer, but trust me, you don't want me to sing anything on this podcast. So it's understand, you know, what we call metacognition. It's understanding, you know, the ways you learn, what you're good at. So ideally, what you would do is help your sons or daughters or, you know, children that you love. You don't have to be a parent to do this, certainly. Children that you love, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, people you care about, not only identify an interest, but kind of match that interest to what their talents are, if they're good at something. And I think that's where you start. So one interesting thing about multipotentiality is what I always say to smart and talented students, and that is you pick one thing that you're most interested in, that you know you have a talent, and you start there and you focus on that for a while. I think otherwise what ends up happening is we see dabblers, and it's great to dabble, but at some point you got to choose a college major. And I don't think it's ever too late, really, even in some of the women that I've interviewed for my project on highly creative women. Some of those women later in life, they dabbled, even though they had doctorates, they dabbled in a number of different things. And then they found something that they were passionate about. In my own academic career, you know, I went, as you mentioned, I went into academic leadership because I felt as a woman that was interested in studying talented and creative women, I couldn't really talk about women's leadership unless I'd experienced it. So I dabbled in that for 6 years. And then I've had grants in one area, grants in another area, but generally I've stayed with a passion area for 5 or 6 years until I feel like I've published enough, I've done enough, I've made an impact. And then in my life, I've gone on to something else. So it's not that you can't do that. It's that you've got to do that with some kind of closure in an area in which you feel you can make a contribution. That's also really, really important to talented, creative people, especially to women. They want to make a contribution to make a difference, to help people, to make their part of the world a little bit better.
So following up on women in education, but specifically STEM education, in some of your earlier work, you had highlighted some of the challenges with the learning experience, the environment for women who may have an interest in STEM, but they've been put off because of a negative experience that they had. And so I'm curious to know whether or not you feel that we've improved a little bit or making progress. But more importantly, if I'm a teacher, how can I become more sensitive to those experiences to make sure that they, if I'm a STEM teacher specifically, how can I be more sensitive to the environment and culture that I'm facilitating in the classroom when it comes to trying to promote STEM careers to women?
Yeah, that's also an excellent question. We've definitely made progress. So, you know, there is great progress that's been made in many areas. For example, most of the medical school classes that are entering now and competitive medical schools in the United States have similar numbers of young men and young women entering. So that's progress. So while there's progress, there's so much work to be done. We still have, you know, very small numbers of women mathematicians. We still have very small numbers of women physicists. We still have very small numbers of women engineers. And there's tremendous progress to be made at the top. So women in STEM careers and leadership positions, very, very few. Women in STEM careers who are presidents of associations, very, very few. I think the biggest challenge remains socialization. So you referred to that earlier, Matt. Matt, you talked a little bit about socialization, and the earlier work that I've done really shows that we are still looking at young girls who probably couldn't identify a woman scientist that's had a major impact, a creative woman scientist in this country, even though there have been dozens, hundreds. We're still seeing many STEM fields as, you know, as men's clubs, as male only. So while we've made progress, and especially made progress in the U.S., we also see, you know, enormous setbacks in other countries. So I actually just did a keynote with educators in India last week. And at the end of the keynote, I just could not believe the comments talking about creative women and the role of women in leadership. And so when we see progress in our country, we have to also realize that in other countries, there's a lack of progress. So we need more women role models. We need more women leaders. We need more women to take over departments. We need more women PhDs in these areas, math professors, for example, you know, statistics professors. So even in applied fields, we're not seeing enough women go in that we can make a difference. As long as we're still talking about it, there's not enough women in those fields. And I think that's what it comes down to. So socialization, representation, and leadership, those three things still have an impact on women in STEM areas. What teachers can do is provide individualized and group support. They can let girls work with other girls in groups. When you have groups of girls and boys working together, boys oftentimes take over the experiments. They take over the computer. I'm a huge fan of single-sex groups. They could provide encouragement. They can encourage parents to have girls involved in extracurricular activities. They could provide women role models. They can find TED Talks by women engineers and women scientists. They can celebrate Women's History Month by bringing in, that's only one month. I'm not saying it should only be in March, but I'm saying that's one very specific thing that can be done. So bringing in role models, finding speakers that are women in STEM, bringing them into schools, finding opportunities for young girls to enter competitions about STEM, and being a support system and being a mentor to a young girl in a STEM area. All of these are critically important for teachers that are trying to support young girls in STEM areas.
I love those recommendations. Thank you so much. They're so useful and simple and easy to implement. I really appreciate that. I'm going to do a little shift and talk about reading, because in our debrief episode of season one, Matt and I had a discussion about reading and how the stories that we expose our students and children to at an early age can help expand their knowledge and curiosity to topics not always covered in the curriculum. So knowing you've done some research on reading, we wondered if you could talk a little bit about exposure to stories and the importance of reading in our lives.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked this question. You know, this is an area of great interest and passion for me. So I had grants for about 7 years, and I was deeply enmeshed in something called the school-wide enrichment model in reading. So an enrichment approach for reading that provided, again, in our philosophy, some enrichment for all readers, but also more advanced books for students that could read at an advanced level. And we created something that is available free on our UConn website, www.gifted.ucon.edu. called School-Wide Enrichment Reading. We created a series of bookmarks. And what we did was create a kind of enrichment approach to reading where every day in reading class, a teacher would do one or two book hooks. And the idea of the book hooks is to get children excited about literature. Now, not only do you get them excited about literature, but you can expose them to different authors, different topics. So think about a 5-minute book hook. So I come on, I may decide that I'm going to expose students to, you know, a book of biographies of women scientists, let's say. And so I might read for 2 minutes about a famous American woman scientist. Let's just pick one. And let's pick, for example, Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring, is one of my personal heroines. And I'm going to do a 2-minute reading about Rachel Carson and introducing kids to a nonfiction book of biographies of famous American women scientists. I've exposed them to a genre. I've exposed them to an incredible woman scientist. I've told them that this book exists. And I've held up the book to say, if you want to read it, I have it here. So the idea of this is if you did that for 180 days of the year, 5 to 10 minutes, one or two book hooks a day, you could get kids excited about reading something, you expose them to 180 different areas of study. And what you do is you do it in a way that's enthusiastic and exciting. And you hopefully, it's an invitation for them to read the book. You can read books of all different genres. You can do book hooks of fiction and nonfiction. You can go through every single type. You can read your favorite books from when you were a child. You can have parents come in and do a book hook. You can have your principal come in and do a book hook. You can invite local authors to come in and do a book hook. And I think what you get is an excitement about reading. Now, you can actually, even if you're unsure of the questions to ask after you've done a book hook, we have this set of bookmarks available free, all different genres, questions that are based on the most appropriately scientific reading strategies. So the strategies to help students read more. And what we found by doing this is we could get kids so excited about reading. There's a couple of video clips about book hooks on our site, but I wish every teacher in America that teaches reading would spend 5 minutes a day doing this. And at the end of the year, again, you'd have 180 books that students and children would be exposed to, children and even teens. Listen, here's the thing. Even adults like to be read to. You know, I have this memory of my husband is a cancer survivor. And I have this profound memory of, I think, the second time, luckily he's healthy today, the second time his cancer came back. And you know, for just a lot of weeks, we were unsure of what the outcome could be. And every night I read to him. And, you know, he was in his 60s. So the point being, even adults like to be read to. I love books on tape. I love listening. You know, I'm a regular listener of Audible books. I think so many free books are available now audibly with a library registration, with a library card. So I think this is something we can see that should be much more pervasive in our classrooms and in our societies. And by the way, this helps students with learning disabilities, with dyslexia, bright kids that have challenges reading. So this is an area that has really so much benefit with so little effort for teachers.
I'm so excited by book hooks right now. Thank you. All right. So we finished all of our shows with request for three tips for educators and parents that they can take away from this discussion. Three things that you would advise to our listeners to consider when bringing creativity into the home and classroom. What are three things that they could do?
Well, number one is exposure, exposure, exposure. So taking your kids to museums, watching TED Talks with them, watching good television. There's nothing wrong with television. I mean, it gets a bad rap, but good screen time, good exposure, exposing them to nature. So exposure, exposure, exposure. That's the first. Second would be interests, helping them to develop an interest. Good exposure leads to strong interests. So looking for interests. Again, it's not that an interest will necessarily last, but the capacity to have an interest is critical. If you were to ask me, you know, to summarize 40 years of my work, I'd say, I want to know that young children can develop the capacity to have an interest. Because when you have an interest, life is better, work is better, your relationships are better. Having an interest makes everything more fun and more engaging and more enjoyable, even if it's an interest that's an avocation or a hobby as opposed to your work. And I guess third is your projects. So project-based learning, giving students an opportunity to be exposed, develop an interest, and then finishing a project with them. You know, having little kids write a little book together or doing a pop-up book, doing a science experiment with them, some kind of project that you work on together when they're younger. And again, they develop this love of doing something. When our youngest daughter, who's an editor and a director and a producer, she's now in an MFA program, but when she was a little girl, you know, she turned our dining room into a puppet stage and we had to buy tickets to get in. And she put on puppet plays daily. And, you know, that kind of creativity. She, by the way, also has a podcast, 51 First Dates. She does dating advice for young women, but she's had a web television series, just super high creative. And I think some of that was developed through our not only encouragement of her doing projects at home, but our enthusiasm for the project she did for home, even when we had to give up our dining room table for several months. So projects, inventions, getting kids involved in things that will teach them the joys and the challenges of creative productivity. Those would be my three tips for parents and teachers.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really great talking to you. And thanks for the work you're doing in creativity. You know, it's something that should be a part of every classroom in America. And it's so easy to give creative opportunities. And yet so few teachers do it regularly. So thank you so much for the work you're both doing. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for the incredible dedication to the field of creativity and education and women. And there's just so many beautiful layers to your work. So thank you so much, Sally Reese, for coming on today and sharing your time and expertise with us. And this concludes this episode of the Fueling Creativity Podcast. I'm Dr. Cindy Burnett.
And my name is Dr. Matthew Werwood.
This show was produced by Creativity and Education and in partnership with TeachersInnovationStudio.com.
On the next episode of the Fueling Creativity podcast, we'll be speaking with STEM educator Jonathan Nalder on education technology and his work at STEMPunks. But until then, keep fueling the conversation using the hashtag #FuelingCreativity.